Chapter 13. Aliman al-Khalifa read the facts once more, then slipped the sheets of paper into a plastic sleeve to protect the image. The cost to the Hamadi group for this information had been the equivalent of 1 million British pounds in gold. The greed and avarice shown by man continued to amaze al-Khalifa. For the right price, most men would sell out their country, their future livelihood, even their god. The insider at Echelon had been no different. A host of gambling debts and poor financial stewardship had placed him in a position to be exploited. A slow seduction and increasingly larger payments for his treason had put him firmly within the Hamadi group's control. And now, after 2 years, the man had come through with a jackpot. The problem was that al-Khalifa had his plate rather full right now. Turning to the other man in the cabin of the yacht, he spoke. "Allah blesses all that believe." Salmain Eski smiled and nodded.
"It seems to be an answered prayer," he agreed, "though it comes at an already bountiful time."
Al-Khalifa stared at him. Eski was small, a shade over 5 feet in height, and as thin as a willow. A native of Yemen, he had dark, dusty skin, a receding chin line, and a mouthful of tiny, pointed teeth stained yellow and brown. Eski was a follower, not particularly smart, but extremely loyal to the cause. All movements needed men like him. They were the pawns to be played, the fodder for the cannon. By contrast, al-Khalifa was tall, handsome, and moved with a grace that generations of leadership had instilled in his soul. For hundreds of years, his ancestors had ruled as tribal leaders on the dusty Arabian Peninsula. It had only been in the last 20 years since al-Khalifa's father had fallen from grace with the Qatari royal family that his bloodline had been reduced to ordinary status. Al-Khalifa was planning to rectify that situation soon. Then he would follow through with his planned strike for Islam.
"Allah has blessed us with the funds to do both," al-Khalifa said, "and we shall."
"So you want the captain to plot a course northeast to the site?" Eski asked.
"Yes," al-Khalifa said quietly. "I'll bring the passenger aboard later."
Flagged in Bahrain and registered as being owned by the Arab Investment and Trading Consortium, the 303-foot-long Akbar was one of the largest privately owned yachts in the world. Few outsiders had ever been aboard the yacht, but those few had spoken of the plush salon, the large hot tubs on the rear deck, and the host of smaller boats, personal watercrafts, and helicopter that she carried. From the outside, the Akbar appeared to be a floating palace owned by someone ultra-rich. Almost no one would guess that she housed a terrorist cell. Along with the leader, al-Khalifa, and the follower, Eski, both now on shore, were 6 more men. 2 were Kuwaitis, 2 were Saudis, and there was 1 Libyan and 1 Egyptian. All of the men were infused with fundamentalist Muslim rhetoric, and all were ready to die for their cause.
"We're clear to leave port,"
the captain said into a handheld radio.
"Once you're free of the outer harbor, begin steaming at full speed," al-Khalifa ordered from shore. "I'll rendezvous with you in an hour and a half."
"Yes, sir,"
the captain answered. Al-Khalifa slid the small telephone back into his front pocket and then stared at the electrical panel in the basement of the hotel again.
"Place the charges there," he said to Eski, pointing to the main trunk line. "After the alarm sounds and it goes dark, meet me at the lower stairwell as we planned."
Eski nodded and began molding the C-6 explosive around the aluminum pipe. He was reaching into his pocket for the firing wires and triggers as al-Khalifa walked away. Crossing through the underground parking garage, al-Khalifa stopped, opened the rear of a van, looked inside, and then closed it up and walked across the lot again. Opening the door to the emergency stairwell, he began climbing up flights of stairs. Once he'd reached the floor directly under the Qatari Emir's suite of rooms, He used his card key to enter a room that had been rented by his shell company. Al-Khalifa glanced at the bed he had flipped up against the wall earlier that day. Then he examined the strange-looking, red-painted machine, sitting on the area of the floor where the bed had formerly resided. Up near the ceiling was a 4-foot-diameter, diamond-tipped, circular saw blade that looked like a giant version of what a woodworker would use to bore a hole in the side of a birdhouse. The blade was attached to a stainless steel shaft powered by hydraulic rams. Below the shaft was a rectangular metal box that housed the diesel engine that was used to power the boring unit. Under the engine box was an axle and automotive-sized wheels that allowed the unit to be towed where it was needed. A portable hand control panel with a 20-foot cable allowed the machine to be remotely operated. When he lowered the blade, there were 6 feet of clearance between it and the ceiling. There was a square piece of plywood and a ladder placed alongside the machine. The entire affair had been brought to the room in parts over a period of weeks and then assembled. Maids had been kept out by giving the front desk strict orders not to have anyone enter the room. The unit was used on construction sites to bore through concrete in order to lay cables. Al-Khalifa figured it would go through a floor just fine. The Emir of Qatar was sleeping peacefully on the floor above. Security teams from the corporation were passing the night on duty in rooms across the hall and adjacent to the Emir's suite. They were sure the snatch would go down tonight. In the room across the hall, Jones and Meadows carefully watched the remote cameras. To the left of the Emir's suite, Monica Crabtree made notes while Cliff Hornsby cleaned a handgun. In the room on the right side of the suite, Holly Kasim and Franklin Lincoln were picking at a platter of sandwiches as they waited. There was nothing to indicate what was about to happen. One floor below, Al-Khalifa placed a pair of night-vision goggles over his eyes, then fingered the remote control and stared at his watch. The seconds ticked past until the hand swept across 3 a.m. Then Al-Khalifa felt a rumble through the floors of the building, and the lights went dead. Al-Khalifa pushed the starter, and the boring machine roared to life. Pressing the button to raise the ram, he watched as the shaft and spinning blade headed toward the ceiling. As soon as the blade made contact with the ceiling, it tore into the drywall and wooden supports, spewing wood slivers and dust into the room. The blade was through the ceiling in less than 10 seconds, and fresh air from above filtered down. Lowering the ram, Al-Khalifa tossed the plywood sheet across the sharp prongs of the blade, then grabbed the control box again, climbed onto the plywood, and raised the ram with the power to the blade shut off. A second later, he was up in the Emir's room and stepped onto the floor. Through the night vision goggles, Al-Khalifa could see someone sitting in bed, rubbing his eyes. Sprinting across the suite, he grabbed a chair and jammed it under the doorknob, then raced back to the Emir's bed. Bending over, he taped the man's mouth and eyes shut, then pulled him from the bed and over to the hole. Once they were both on the plywood, he used the remote to lower the shaft and then pulled the man onto the floor and dragged him toward the door. Opening the door, he pulled the man down the hallway to the fire escape stairs and down. Less than 2 minutes had passed since Al-Khalifa had started his plan. A few minutes more, and he'd be on the road. "Got it," Jones said. The corporation teams were outfitted with small, powerful flashlights that clipped onto their belts. 8 thin beams of light flickered in the hall outside the Emir's suite. "The light went green," Meadows shouted after slipping an extra card key through the slot outside the Emir's suite. "But the door won't open."
"Ali," Jones shouted, "you and Lincoln, go down to the garage and block the exit."
The pair of men raced off.
"Crabtree, Hornsby," he added, "guard the lobby exit." "Bob, back away," Jones said. "I'm going to blow the door."
Pulling a round metallic disc from his pocket, Jones removed a piece of paper protecting the high-strength tape, slapped it on the door, and flicked a small switch on the side.
"Sir," he shouted at the door, "back away from the door! We're coming in!"
Jones and Meadows moved a short distance down the hall and waited for the charge to explode. As soon as it had gone off, Jones raced over and pushed through the shattered remains of the door. Racing toward the bedroom, he panned the flashlight across the bed. It was empty. Scanning the room with the thin beam of light, he came across the hole cut in the floor. Then he reached for his portable radio and called the Oregon.
"Code red," he said. "The principal has been taken."
As he waited for a reply, Jones surveyed the bedroom.
"Bob, see what's down there."
Meadows climbed through the hole.
"What's happening there?"
Hanley asked when he came on the line.
"They grabbed our player," Jones said quickly.
"Now that,"
Hanley said slowly,
"was not part of the plan."
"This is the bottom of the stairs," Al-Khalifa said to his blindfolded abductee.
Al-Khalifa was still wearing the night vision goggles, but from what he could see, His Excellency did not seem overly frightened. He was just following along with Al-Khalifa, as if his security forces had taught him not to resist.
"Come this way," Al-Khalifa said, opening the door to the garage and dragging the emir by the arm.
Eski appeared in the goggles at the same moment that Al-Khalifa heard footsteps from above.
"Open the door of the van and remove the motorcycle," he shouted.
Eski raced over to the van, opened the rear door, and slid a ramp down to the pavement. Then he climbed inside the van and pushed the bike down the ramp. The metal ice studs embedded in the motorcycle's tires clicked like locusts on the metal ramp. Al-Khalifa had managed to pull the emir over to the van. He reached inside and removed an AK-47 assault rifle from the van's floor. Holding the emir's shirt with one hand, he swiveled around and pointed the rifle toward the door. He opened fire as soon as Kasim, followed by Lincoln, exited the stairway and came through the door. At the same instant, Eski pushed the starter button. The BMW 650 with sidecar roared to life. Kasim was hit in the arm by a round, but he managed to flop on his stomach and roll under a car. Lincoln escaped injury, and he crouched alongside his partner and withdrew his sidearm. He sighted down the barrel, but the emir was in his field of fire.
"Cover my escape," Al-Khalifa said, handing Eski the rifle.
Eski took the AK-47 and started spraying the area near the stairwell with controlled bursts. Al-Khalifa pushed the emir into the sidecar and climbed aboard the motorcycle. Reaching for the clutch lever, he clicked the BMW into gear, then goosed the throttle and pulled away from the van. Eski increased his fire. Al-Khalifa steered to the ramp leading out of the underground facility and started to drive up to ground level. Lincoln reached for the microphone on his lapel and called the Oregon.
"The principal is aboard a BMW motorcycle," he shouted.
Kasim balanced his handgun in his good arm. Carefully, taking aim, he squeezed off a trio of rounds that struck Eski in the groin, heart, and throat. He dropped to the ground like a sack of potatoes, and the AK-47 fell to the concrete floor. Lincoln raced across the distance to the van, slid the rifle farther away, and stood guard over the dying man. The sound from the BMW grew faint in the distance. Hitting the top of the ramp at ground level, the BMW's front wheel pawed at the air. Al-Khalifa threw his weight forward to bring the wheel down and exited the parking structure onto the road in front of the hotel. He turned right, down Steinton Road, and traveled a few blocks to where it intersected with Seibrout, before turning east and racing along the harbor. The road led out of town, and there was no traffic. Al-Khalifa stared at the emir in the sidecar. The man seemed strangely unafraid. After racing across the lobby and bursting through the hotel's front door, Crabtree and Hornsby caught sight of the retreating motorcycle. They raced for their black SUV parked in front of the hotel.
"Okay, everyone,"
Hanley said over the radio from the Oregon's control room.
"Our principal is aboard a BMW motorcycle."
Hornsby hit the key to unlock the doors of the SUV and climbed into the driver's seat. Crabtree reached for her radio as she sat down.
"They turned east and are driving along the harbor," she said. "We're giving chase."
Al-Khalifa twisted the throttle and took the BMW to 70 miles an hour on the snow-covered road. Passing three turnoffs, they crossed over a hill and were out of sight of Reykjavik. Watching the side of the road carefully, he located a trail where he had packed down the snow yesterday with a rented snowmobile. He turned onto the narrow strip of packed snow and drove over another small hill. A fjord with a thin crust of ice extended almost to the base of the hill. Suddenly, civilization seemed far away. There, on a pad of packed snow, a Kawasaki helicopter was waiting.
Hornsby slowed the SUV as they passed the first turnoff and glanced at the snow for tracks. Finding none, he stepped on the gas and checked the next. Slowing to check the side roads was killing time, but Hornsby and Crabtree had no other choice. The BMW motorcycle was nowhere to be seen.
Al-Khalifa placed the blindfolded Amir in the passenger seat of the Kawasaki, then locked the door from the outside with a key. He had removed the inside latch from the passenger side, and now the Amir had no way out. Walking around to the front of the helicopter, he climbed into the pilot's seat and slid the key into the ignition. As he waited while the igniters warmed, he stared over at his prisoner.
"Do you know who I am?" he asked. The Amir, still blindfolded with mouth taped shut, simply nodded.
"Good," Al-Khalifa said. "Then it's time to take a little trip."
Twisting the key, he waited until the turbines had reached proper thrust. Then he pulled up on the collective and lifted the Kawasaki from the snow. Once the helicopter was 10 feet off the ground, he eased the cyclic forward. The Kawasaki moved forward, passed through ground effect as it rose in the air, then headed out to sea. Keeping the helicopter low over the terrain to blend in with the mountains, Al-Khalifa looked backward toward Reykjavik.
"The tracks end here," Hornsby said, staring down at the snow through the open door of the SUV.
Crabtree was glancing out the side window.
"There," she said, pointing. "There's a pack trail."
Hornsby stared at the thin trail.
"The snow's too soft. We'll just get stuck."
After calling the Oregon, who quickly dispatched George Adams in the corporation's Robinson helicopter, Hornsby and Crabtree started hiking along the packed trail. They found the BMW motorcycle 10 minutes later. By the time Adams flew overhead, they had figured out what had happened. They called him on the radio.
"We have a blast patch from a rotor blast," Hornsby reported.
"I'll keep an eye out for another chopper," Adams said.
Adams flew as far from Reykjavik as he could before fuel ran low, but he saw no other helicopters. The Amir had simply vanished, as if plucked from the earth by a giant hand.